Good evening. I'm Michael McCusker. Happy Bastille Day, 222. And I'd like to devote some of the program this morning to Bastille Day. Bastille Day, July 14th, is French Independence Day and is generally regarded as the beginning of the French Revolution in 1789. The hated symbol of kings and arbitrary rule, the French rebels were determined to attack and destroy the prison. They were joined, unexpectedly, by the Garde Française, which had been sent to stop them. When the Bastille defenders refused to surrender, the mob stormed the prison and destroyed it. That the Bastille was attacked with an enthusiasm of heroism such as only the highest animation of liberty could inspire, wrote Thomas Paine in The Rights of Man. As it is not difficult to perceive from the enlightened state of mankind, the hereditary governments are verging to their decline, and that revolutions on the broad basis of national sovereignty and government by representation are making their way in Europe. It would be an act of wisdom to anticipate their approach and produce revolution by reason and accommodation, rather than commit them to the issue of convulsions. From what we now see, nothing of reform in the political world ought to be held improbable. It is an age of revolutions in which everything may be looked for. And that was Thomas Paine and The Rights of Man. And I certainly believe that that applies to the Arab Spring and now the Arab Summer occurring in the Mideast. And I'd like to read something about the Bastille that Catherine Bridget Snow wrote a number of years ago for my newspaper, the North Coast Times-Eagle, which I have read a couple of times here. You might recognize her more by her radio name at NPR, Cat Snow, from San Francisco. Liberty and the Bastille. If you stand at night in the center of Paris's golden-lit bridge, Le Pont de la Concorde, and face roughly west, you will see to the right La Tour Eiffel, its graceful lines and small lights against a dark blue sky. To the left is the Cathedral de Notre Dame, sitting quietly at a bend in the slow river, looking small in the distance. It's not far from the cathedral to where you stand, perhaps a 30-minute walk, past the Palace of Justice, past the Louvre Museum, where one king used to hunt on horseback down the long halls, through the Garden of the Tuileries, to the Place de la Concorde. La Place de la Concorde is a whirlpool of cars, four deep, swirling around a tall monument at the center, then streaming down the Seine, or up the Champs-Élysées. The U.S. Embassy is just on the other side of the place, as are the fine leather glove and handbag shops. This is what you would see as an American visitor to the city. If, however, you are a Parisian factory worker in the summer of 1789, you might have tread those 30 minutes from the Hôtel de Ville behind Notre Dame to Les Invalides between the Pont de la Concorde, and taken one of the 32,000 muskets stored there to defend yourself against the king's troops rumored to be surrounding Paris. And if you were a woman a few years later, you might have sat with Dickens's Madame Defarge in the Place de la Concorde near the guillotine and knitted as trumble after trumble rolled past, carrying aristocracy to be beheaded. Tradition has it that the French Revolution began with the storming of the Bastille in a peasant's revolt against aristocratic power, the 14th of July, 1789. But the crowd's original intent was not to free prisoners. It was to demand ammunition to protect the people of Faubourg Saint-Antoine, towards whom the Bastille cannon was pointed. There had been minor revolts for 3 days over the state of the Parliamentary Assembly at Versailles, and Parisians feared more violence from the aristocracy and military. The people of Faubourg Saint-Antoine feared cannon fire from the Bastille to the west and an imminent attack from some 30,000 troops rumored to be coming from the east. There were only 7 prisoners in the Bastille on July 14th, 1789, non-political prisoners. The fortress had long been used only for discreet imprisonment of the wealthy or influential. While it still represented despotism for the workers, few, if any, of the thousands amassing outside of it that day were in a position to know who might be inside the fortress. The government had been unsteady for some time, but the balance of power tipped discernibly towards the assembly in mid-June, when King Louis XVI ordered the parliamentary assembly, the Third Estate, to dissolve, and they refused. The king stopped just short of using military force. Instead, on July 11th, Louis sent the director of finance, Necker, into exile. Bankers and shopkeepers who had looked to Necker's fiscal policies to restore a sound economy protested and marched up the Champs-Élysées into skirmishes with the king's soldiers, who were, for the most part at the time, Hessian mercenaries, which had been used in the American Revolution a few years earlier. Communications with the court at Versailles were cut off July 13th. Rumors flew that the king's troops were surrounding the city, strengthened with large groups of brigands, the outlaws who destroyed crops from village to town and survived through smuggling and violence. Parisians made the trek to the Bastille on the 14th for ammunition and for self-defense. They did not know that the governor inside the fortress, Delaunay, had no provisions, no orders from Versailles, an ineffective cannon, and a garrison of mostly aged soldiers who did not want to open fire at the people. Negotiations between Delaunay and members of the bourgeoisie began amicably until each side, misinterpreting the other, thought it was under attack. Crowds pushed across the drawbridge. Most of the garrison escaped, and the rest were killed. Delaunay made it as far as the Hotel de Ville before his head was speared to parade around the city. It was the beginning of a violence that would escalate in 3 years to the Reign of Terror, the bloody extermination of the aristocracy, romanticized in A Tale of Two Cities and The Scarlet Pimpernel. It is controversial whether or not the economy played a large role in the Revolution of 1789. The price of grain had been the source of unrest and riots in the provinces since early that year. Relaxed export laws had pulled much excess grain from storage, and the harvest of 1788 was poor. Bread prices doubled in Paris and quadrupled in the provinces. Vintners were especially hard hit, since the grape harvest had been abnormally good, driving down the price of wine. The aristocracy was suspected of a conspiracy to hoard grain and keep the price up. The brigands terrorizing the countryside were suspected of being in the employ of the aristocracy. However, it was Necker's dismissal that provided the people of Paris with a concrete reason for massive protest. Necker had a name for reform and sound finance, and it had been disagreements over specific economic proposals which put the very existence of the assembly in question. Paris was on edge over the threats to the Third Estate and the rumored looming massacre by government troops and brigands. Necker's exile was the outrage which began the riots. In the provinces, word of the Paris riots spread, and peasants attacked the chateau, destroying records of credit and debt. Their own revolt was not a direct protest of events at Versailles. They had distrusted Necker for supposed deals with grain millers, which benefited landowners. The peasants were starving, they were penniless, and they were afraid of the traveling brigands. As the struggle continued between the king and the increasingly powerful National Assembly and the various interests of the bourgeoisie and the working class, the food shortage did not abate. By October, the aristocracy had all exited to Versailles, and the Parisians pushed for Louis's return to Paris as a solution to the unrest and economic crises. He returned in early October to the Louvre, and the assembly followed, installing itself at the Tuileries on November 9th. In the ensuing struggle for power between the king and the assembly, the king gradually lost his sovereign rule. Few people would have foreseen the coming terror, when the guillotine would reign sovereign over the bloody Place de Concorde. The Tuileries are just east of the Place de la Concorde, with well-groomed trees planted in even squares and long, straight paths which stretch to the Louvre. Walking north across the Pont de la Concorde, you can turn and walk through the long gardens towards the lights of the Louvre beyond, or you could meander up the Champs-Élysées, admiring the fur coats and pet poodles which parade up and down the boulevard. Either way you turn, you will walk through the Place de la Concorde. History is alive in Paris. The passion is embedded in the streets. As you walk through the place, it takes only a little concentration to imagine the streets sticky with wine and blood, and yourself pressed into the crowd, standing before the guillotine. And that was by Catherine Bridget Snow. She lived in France several years ago, and you can hear her on NPR from San Francisco. Her radio moniker is Cat Snow. Now, along the lines of history, I'd like to read something written by another friend of mine, Lexi Lee. It's about the history of a coin, and I'll just let her tell it. She wrote this just recently, just after her 18th birthday, which, by the way, was on April 19th, which that date in 1775 was the day of the shot heard round world, when the American Revolution began, April 19th, 1775. So in a way, we have two revolutions today. The Birthday Coin by Lexi Lee. For my 18th birthday, I got a special and very cool present from my Uncle John. He gave me a 1,698-year-old Roman coin, fact, because I love old things. The coin is a little chipped and rugged, but you can still see the face of Licinius I, who ruled ancient Rome where the coin was minted in 313 A.D., fact. I began to wonder how the coin had traveled and its adventures from ancient Rome to Astoria, Oregon. In 317, Constantine, who co-ruled the Roman Empire with Licinius I, celebrated his son Constantine II's first birthday, the same day the child was named Caesar. Fact. I imagine a household slave, Arria, slipping my coin into the child's pocket, as it was the only thing she had to give this favored child. For 90 years or so, it could have laid in the dirt where the young Constantine II dropped it when he was playing with it. The Visigoths destroyed Rome in 410, fact. A conquering soldier possibly picked it up when he spotted something shiny in the dust and absent-mindedly put it in his pocket as the army started off to Spain. When the army reached Toledo in Spain, he could have met and fallen in love with the beautiful daughter of a Spanish blacksmith who repaired his dented battle sword. It was Amaranta's birthday, and the Visigoth, Hathus, wanted to give her something special. As soldiers usually don't carry much with them, the only thing Hathus could think to give Amaranta was my coin. When the Visigoth army left Spain, Hathus thought often of Amaranta and the coin. The coin might have been stolen from Amaranta by a Vandal woman named Radegund, who cooked for the army. The coin may have found itself in Africa, because that was where the Vandals went after battling in Spain and losing to the Visigoths. Fact. She was staying with the blacksmith and his daughter and took the coin with her when the Vandals fled to northern Africa. Fact. The Vandals made Tunisia their home. Fact. And the coin could have become an heirloom that passed down through Radegund's family for 300 years. Her great, 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 great grandson, Lothar, received the coin on his 20th birthday as he prepared to go to battle with the Arabs who conquered Carthage around 700 AD. Fact. Perhaps when the Arabs divided the belongings of the defeated Vandals, as was the custom in war, a Muslim man, Anwar, was delighted to realize that he was in possession of an ancient Roman coin. He could give it to his nephew, Aqil, for his 10th birthday when he returned to Mecca. Although Aqil loved his coin, he made a wise decision to drop it into a wishing well and made a birthday wish of peace for his people. The coin eventually was covered by hundreds of other wishing coins, remaining buried for hundreds of years. During the Crusades in 1095, it could have happened that a Spanish crusader, Alfonso, climbed into a well in a desert oasis near Mecca to try to find water for his thirsty troops. He discovered that the well wasn't a drinking well, but a dry ritual wishing well for coins. Leaving the coins mostly undisturbed, he recognized a Roman coin, which would interest his twin brother, who collected coins, and decided to give it to him for his birthday. He returned to Spain with the coin, unaware of a growing hole in his coin purse. I imagine the coin making it to Spain, but dropped in the shallow water of Barcelona as Alfonso got off his ship. During a storm in 1588, a Spanish soldier, Miguel, spotted my coin, now a little rusty, on the beach as he set off for the fight to fight the English with the Spanish Armada. During the defeat of the Armada, he lost the coin in battle, and it could have possibly been picked up as a trinket by an English peasant, Bernard, whose only daughter, Mary, waited for him fearfully, hoping he would return by her 16th birthday. When he gave her the coin on her birthday, she swore she would keep it forever. Mary Norris could have carried the coin in her small baggage when she sailed with other pilgrims on the Mayflower to the New World in 1620. She lost the coin in 1650 when she died at 76 years of age. Her husband, Isaac Allerton, put her prized possessions in a wooden box, and they were forgotten for about 50 years, till the daughter of Deborah Hitchborn bought the box at an auction and gave the coin to his newborn daughter. Deborah was the wife of Apollos Revois, fact, and they were the parents of Paul Revere. Deborah could have given the coin to Paul on his 19th birthday as he took over the family metalsmith shop when Apollos suddenly died. Paul never removed the coin from his pocket and kept it for good luck. Then, in 1775, the coin flew out of Paul Revere's pocket as his horse raced wildly on his famous ride, which was the night of her birthday. Lexi Lees. It is possible the coin began a zigzag stop-and-go, lost-and-found journey west by coach and pony express, by foot and on wagon trains from Boston to Oregon. It began when a Boston woman spotted the coin in 1836 while going to visit her daughter, who was starting her journey westward to Missouri by stagecoach, leaving on her 18th birthday with the birthday coin to remember her mother left behind. She might have sold it to start her life in Independence, Missouri, and years later my birthday coin found itself traveling to Colorado by horseback with a hearty band of adventurers. It was lost as the men panned for gold in the Rockies, and I imagine a pioneer woman washing clothes in the stream finding the coin. The next day she left in a wagon train for Oregon, through Utah and Idaho, the Dalles, and finally the Columbia River in Oregon, where the settlers made their home near Portland in 1849. In 2011, a beautiful young woman, Samantha, Sam, Jewel, whose family was among the original wagon train settlers, needed money to save her home from foreclosure and decided to sell her beloved family coin on the internet. She hoped that it would be a special coin for a special person, and her wish came true. On April 19th, 2011, I opened a tiny birthday gift from my Uncle John and got a big surprise, an ancient Roman coin. Fact. And that was by Lexi Lee, or Alexia. The birthday coin. And she received that on April 19th, the beginning of the American Revolution, for her 18th birthday this year. Now I'd like to read something by a friend of mine named Anthony Zenor. And he calls it the Closet Citizen. A term which has surfaced with all of the fanfare of a new flu bug is that of closet liberal. I first started to hear this smarmy nomenclature being used during the reign of George W. Bush, whereas since then, amongst many Democrats, it has apparently become some sort of liability to be even slightly on the left. This undercurrent of deniability of one's true political beliefs has continued and was clearly seen during the 2008 presidential election. All one had to do was look at the dubious political ads and infomercials, where instead of a capital D appearing next to a politician's name to indicate party affiliation, there was nothing. Even worse was the advent of the phrase, more closely representing, prior to the word Democrat or even Republican or independent respective parties. But I must say that the party which is most in hiding of its own party identity and supposed ideals is the Democratic Party. At one time, this party seemed to be able to stand toe-to-toe with right-wing demagogues and take them to task when ridiculous rhetoric such as trickle-down economics or smaller government were excreted onto newspaper pages, the internet, and the airwaves. There seemed at one time to be a definite yin-yang balance between the money-grubbing, militaristic right-wing elitists hell-bent to lower taxes for themselves while slashing social programs for children, the poor, and the elderly, and the idealistic FDR-inspired left-wingers who saw the need to prevent wars and the ravages of deregulation. This balance has been lost, and everybody can see its disastrous results, but nobody can really figure out how it vanished so completely, or more importantly, fathom how to get it back. What is truly frightening is the total lack of desire to insert this socio-political conscience back into the fiber of this country in the first place. What has been seen so clearly during the last decade is such an intense lust for piles of money, shiny cars, medicine cabinets full of ill-gotten prescription meds, and sprawling homes filled with spoiled, overindulged, underdisciplined children and child pets that any and all sense of political and moral conscience among Democrats simply vanished like a feather in the wind. It is simply and maddeningly got stamped upon in the quest to figure out how to get to the top of the Maslowian hierarchy of financial needs. That is really how petty the once laudable Democratic Party has become in this pettiness epidemic, which continues to sweep the nation. This is the underpinning of the term closet liberal. In other words, it is not financially rewarding to speak out against the ruinous outcome of debacles, such as the deregulation of banks and Wall Street. Those Democrats who have stock portfolios containing shares of the military-industrial complex corporations remain mute as we continue to invade non-threatening countries under the guise of removing supposedly threatening leaders and non-existent piles of weaponry. Democrats also remain mute as Medicare and Medicaid are under assault again, with the same rhetoric from the right of the aisle that big government is bad, all the while ultra-rich Republicans line their pockets with PAC money from a host of pharmaceutical mega global corporations. But the sad thing is that Democrats are also now lined up for the same PAC money. They are also in line for the huge profits to be made on Wall Street. Why else would Wall Streeter Timothy Geithner have been handpicked by President Barack Obama to be current U.S. Secretary of the Treasury? Keep in mind, Geithner was previously the president of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York and was right in the middle of the 2008 real estate bubble bank bailout disaster, which destroyed the savings and pension plans of thousands of Americans. Democrats also remain silent as more and more American companies jump on the treasonous global economy bandwagon, exporting jobs while the unemployment rate hovers at around 10%. These same Democrats remain silent as tariffs and anti-monopoly laws fade into the past, along with the ideology that producing our own goods keeps us strong and independent. Perhaps the biggest disappointment is the current lack of response from the Democratic Party when our rights are being violated at every turn. In the post-9/11 climate, we have seen posse comitatus evaporate, habeas corpus disappear, and the ability for American citizens to talk on the phone or email each other without being eavesdropped upon slip away in this now apparently warrantless country. We are also having to stomach the peptic continued existence of the CIA torture prisons located all over the globe, as well as the existence of Guantanamo, housing enemy combatants, even though our current Democratic president got elected in the midst of campaign promises to close it down immediately. Most recently, this past May, we all had to witness the apparent removal of all Democratic vocal cords when the U.S. Supreme Court announced that no warrant is needed if police discern destruction of evidence, essentially nullifying the Fourth Amendment's requirement that police obtain a court-authorized search warrant before entering a private home. But this is who the Democratic Party has become, at least at the upper echelon. On the lower rungs, there are still those of us who must simply grumble under our breath as more and more high-profile Democrats acquiesce to the ultra-rich individuals and corporations now looked upon legally as individuals. Never has Ralph Nader's maddeningly concise quote, "There can be no daily democracy without daily citizenship," been more apropos. And that was The Closet Citizen by Anthony Zenor. And I must say, that is a nom de plume for someone who lives here on the North Coast. And as I only have a short period of time, I'd like to read a poem, such as, well, here's a statement by Elliot Janeway, which plays into the last article I just read, and perhaps the Bastille article. "Idealists live under greater pressure to reckon with politics than politicians do to compromise with ideals." And from Peter Marin, A Case for Utopia. "The world would be better off if people tried to become better, and people would become better if they stopped trying to become better off. For when everybody tries to become better off, nobody is better off. Everybody would be rich if nobody tried to become richer, and nobody would be poor if everybody tried to be the poorest. And everybody would be what they ought to be if everybody tried to be what they thought everybody else ought to be." And that was Peter Marin, A Case for Utopia. You've been listening to A Story Told. I'm Michael McCusker.